Welcome to New Books in Critical Theory. On this episode, I'll be talking to Paul Bennyworth from the University of Twente, who's one of the authors of The Impact and Future of Arts and Humanities Research.
Welcome to New Books in Critical Theory. On this episode, I'm talking to Paul Bennyworth, who is Senior Researcher at the Centre of Higher Education Policy Studies at the University of Twente in the Netherlands, about a book he's a co-author on called The Impact and Future of Arts and Humanities Research, which came out of a very big project thinking precisely about the impact, future, and value of the arts and humanities in Europe. So welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here today, Dave.
I think we might start by just giving the listeners a sense of your research work, your kind of research agenda, and how you came to be involved in this big question about the impact and future of arts and humanities.
So my research has always been interested in the value of knowledge for society. So I started out doing my PhD at Newcastle University. And really what I wanted to do was to understand why the Northeast was changing. So I come from the Northeast of England, and I grew up at a time when Thatcher was closing down the industries. And it was a terrible time. There was a huge amount of devastation and dereliction. And from the 1990s, there was some gradual efforts made to try and improve things. The Tyne and Wear Development Corporation were involved. They were investing in business parks. They created the Centre for Life. And I wanted to study that. And if you're working in a region like the northeast of England, in terms of modernising the economy, there aren't many actors who are really doing that. And so as I was studying for my PhD at the Centre for Urban and Regional Development Studies, I came across the work of Gareth Potts, who was doing a PhD at the same time, looking at the role of universities. And the theme of universities gradually bubbled up in my PhD as representing a source of potential growth for a region like the northeast of England. And this sparked in me an interest in how universities were contributing to society. And that has moved forward in a variety of iterations. Now, I've never really been interested in the things like the Oxford or the Cambridge phenomenon, where you have a world-class university in a thriving economy creating new high-tech business, high-tech startups and spin-offs. I've always been interested in the kind of the places that get left behind, the communities that get left behind. So I was working on an ESRC project that was looking at the role of universities in socially excluded communities. And that really started to highlight some of the barriers that even very well-meaning universities can have when they start to try and create benefits for the communities that are experiencing problems in the context of the knowledge economy. And so that's kind of been the leitmotif of my work, looking at these difficult cases. And I'd already started to do some work looking at arts and humanities research, because that's a very good example of a difficult case. It's hard to understand how arts and humanities can contribute to society in the kind of instrumental discourses that policymakers are now using. And so really, it was in about 2009, two things came together. There was my interest in the value of universities for society. And then there was a group of arts and humanities research councils across Europe had come to the same conclusion about this public discourse, that the way that humanities was operating, it was seen outside of the academy as being very stuffy, as being very self-satisfied, unwilling to justify itself. And in particular, the research councils in the UK and the Netherlands and Denmark had tried to bring humanities research councils together to create a new future research agenda for what, if you were to create a dynamic humanities research environment in Europe, what would that look like? And they call this network the Humanities in the European Research Area. So how could arts and humanities research create European added value in the way that we saw, for example, in nanotechnology research or energy research, where there was an assumption that academics would work across national boundaries on these large projects of national interest, and not find it strange to be working with all kinds of societal partners. And they managed to get some money from the European Commission, and they put together this joint research program. And I was looking at this, and I was reading the call for it, really from a research perspective, because this I thought, well, perhaps I can study this. But it became clear to me that the one thing that they'd taken for granted in this was they had a very simplistic idea of the public value of arts and humanities research. So they said that it had value, but there was the risk that they were going to get drawn into the trap of assuming that arts and humanities research value was small projects that fed into a very limited segment of the creative industries and ultimately would lead to a dissatisfaction amongst funders, amongst policymakers, because of the relatively limited scale of the impact. So you had, I was interested in value, you had HERA, and so I put together this proposal and called it HERA Value, for which was a European research network to study this issue of the public value of arts and humanities research more widely, really out of my own interest to understand this really quite complicated example of how knowledge can create value. Because if you understand how philosophy can benefit society, it gives you insights into the various ways that, for example, biotechnology can benefit society without necessarily reducing it to the production of drugs.
You cleared the ground really, really perfectly, actually, for understanding the story of the book. And I might ask kind of two questions to further develop what you've said. The first thing is why are we actually asking this question? What is the public value of the arts and humanities research? You know, why are we asking that now? And then obviously allied to that has been the rise of various both research and also kind of public policy and public discourse agendas around the idea of research having impact. So I wonder if you could, yeah, sort of tell me a little bit about what impact is, what it means, why we're kind of talking about it, but, you know, also illustrate that. Why is this question, what's the public value of arts and humanities research, being asked now?
So the first question was, why are we asking this question of what is the public value of arts and humanities research? And it's the first thing that you have to understand about asking this question is that it's not, in the case of arts and humanities question, a neutral question. No, the starting point that people have taken in the public sphere is not, tell us all the good things that you're doing because we're interested to hear them. Anytime this question has been asked in the general public policy sphere, it has been a question of the form, tell us how arts and humanities research is doing, is contributing as much to society as the proper sciences, and if you don't, we're going to cut your money. Because what we've seen is that a discourse has emerged in public policy that science is useful, and that science can easily and quickly point to the kinds of benefits that it creates. And the arts and humanities, for a variety of reasons, produced a very unsatisfactory set of answers to that question. So it's almost as if it's a resit examination for arts and humanities, with a lot of pressure being put on them. Now, really tell us what you're doing, because if you don't, then you're not doing proper research. What we've seen is that the first round of answers that were produced. So Eleonora Belfiore, she's traced the way that people have attempted to mobilize a set of arguments for the intrinsic value of arts and humanities research, where people say that society benefits simply because the research is being done. And that, for a variety of reasons, is a very unsatisfactory answer, because it's difficult to make a logical decision between that being true, or distinction between that being true, and you saying that because you don't want to have to justify the value that you create as an arts and humanities researcher in return for the value that you receive. But the consequence of that has been to change the way that the question has been answered. So the question has always been answered under pressure. And the fact that the question is being put in a pressurized way, now justify your value, has skewed the debate and produced a series of reactions where we've seen, for example, people contesting the terms of those asking the questions, who've assumed that it's an attempt to impose a new type of logic around the decisions that are made about what kind of research is good or not. And policymakers and this is where HERA really came from as a research network. Policymakers in arts and humanities research were aware that this was taking place. So they've attempted to reframe the question in a more positive way, to construct an argumentation that is acceptable to the arts and humanities research community, but also acceptable to the policymakers community. And that, when we started the project, we were expecting to find that this would be relatively uncontroversial, that the structures would exist, that would emerge, there would be discussions and dialogues that would produce a common view around what the public value of humanities research was. But what we found was that stabilization process didn't happen. So what we ended up tracing was we attempted to take a step back and to tell a more general story about what was happening in terms of the different kinds of ways that arts and humanities research was creating value.
Yeah, and this gets done really neatly in the book, in both a kind of an explicit way by thinking about national case studies, Norway, Ireland, yeah, and the Netherlands, yeah, but also it gets done in this, I suppose, more meta way about thinking about why we're even engaging in these both questions, but also practices of demonstrating things like impact. And I think we might have a think about two questions before we turn to the kind of substantive empirical engagements that are in the book. The first is the institutional setting for all of this.
Yeah.
Which is the university. And one of the things that the book does in the introduction is kind of set out almost a kind of a history of institutional change in the form of the emergence of, I guess, kind of new university practices. And I wonder if you could say a bit about actually what's the institutional setting for these discussions has been and how the university has changed maybe since the 1970s.
I think one of the interesting things is that people assume that there's some kind of heyday of higher education where it was an ivory tower and people were simply allowed to go about their business. And it was a better science policy scholar than me that pointed out that the universities, since their creation, have always served a societal purpose and they've always had a societal funder. And it was was it Pope Pius XIII who created the University of Paris because he needed a seminary for training priests? And so he created a special class of priest, the prebendary stipend holder, who that turned into what we would think of as the lecturer, simply because the Pope needed a highly educated elite in order to run the Catholic Church. The Catholic Church hierarchy. And since then, we've seen the university has always had this kind of sponsor dependence. And that has affected the institutional structure and the way that the university carries out its function. And in the 1970s, there was a huge amount of emphasis was put in universities across Europe in using them as a means to open up and democratize society. So in the 1960s, there was a series of protests. People think most famously of France and the May 1968 revolts. But that kind of student activism related to labor strikes sparked a whole wave of unrest across Europe and North America that led to an opening up of the institution of the university. And it became seen as a place that was about educating a mass democratic society. So previously, universities had been about creating elites, and where they'd been associated with societal opening, it had been about creating new kinds of elites to run those societies, whether industrial or political. But now they were seen about giving everyone the tools that they needed to function in an increasingly open democratic society. So obviously the big change since the 1970s is that there has been an increasing individualization of the way that society and societal value is viewed. And inevitably that has had an impact on the way that the university functions as an institution, because it's the way that the public sector articulates what societal interest is has changed. So there's become an increasing emphasis on the role of the university in giving individuals the tools that they need in order to live more effectively more productive lives. And this has had a differential disciplinary impact. So it's much easier for the disciplines that can point to the fact that they give functional tools to individuals to go immediately into employment, that they're doing research that leads to the creation of patents, licenses, spin-off companies. It becomes, in these new circumstances, much easier for them to justify the value that they've had. And so when you have a whole set of disciplines that have become embedded in a kind of consensus that their value lies in enriching the individual to flourish in a democratic society, that then makes it quite difficult for them to start to mobilize arguments about how they are contributing to individual attempts to enrich themselves. Because the tools that arts and humanities research creates, the understanding, the reflection, the critical voices, they create second, third order benefits for society. And it becomes much harder to point to those second and third order benefits when other people who are in competition with you for scarce public resources are able to say, we create highly educated graduates that earn a lot of money, that set up businesses, that generate taxes and lead to economic growth. And so the contemporary university has become a place where the arts and humanities research is facing a series of pressures to behave in ways that don't necessarily lead to the optimal public benefits, because those second and third order benefits are still there. And we point to them, we're able to point to them in the empirical case studies, but they just, in the context of the public debate, they become much less compelling, much less convincing to policymakers. And so what we've tried to understand is precisely why that has been the case. Why have policymakers been so resistant to arguments as to the value cut from arts and humanities research comes indirectly? But again, the idea of making a positive contribution to public debate, that's quite a vague concept. Certainly, it's a lot more vague than creating a spin-off company that employs 300 people. But there's this second issue about economism, and hopefully we can kind of drill into this in a little while, that the first order benefits, the financial benefits, the economic benefits, they're something that's relatively easily enumerated. And they're also something that is uncontroversially positive. So if you create a spin-off company and it employs people, then you can point to it has it adds £100,000 to GDP per employee, generally speaking. And everyone, all the major political parties buy in and say, that's a good thing. That is unambiguously positive. But a lot of the apparent societal benefits that come through things like critical thinking, their public value is politically constructed. So there is a consensus that economic growth is good, but there is not necessarily a consensus that all communities being able to articulate their interests in an equal way is good. Perhaps 10 years ago, we might have assumed that was the case, but we see in the rise of all kinds of populist movements that there are political parties that seem to feel that the critical reflective tools that arts and humanities research brings to society actually have a negative value. And so even in a well-functioning democracy, democratic system, it's much more difficult to point to things like the value of critical reflectiveness as an unambiguous social benefit, because not all political parties agree with the consequences and outcomes of that. And you see in countries like Canada, where there's been until very recently a very strong political attack on researchers who were seen as doing research that had positive value viewed from the left but not from the right. That's an issue that a lot of policymakers see as being above their pay grade. They know what good research is because it has an unambiguous positive value as articulated in pounds. And all of this kind of woolly stuff around critical thinking, that's just contentious, so we'll rule that out. And that has had very negative consequences in the first instance for the kind of reception that attempts by arts and humanities researchers to articulate the value of their research has had. And nevertheless, organizations like AHRC and the British Academy have put a huge amount of effort into trying to articulate stories that have a more neutrally positive tenor, you might say. So there's this great example of, is it the Black in Britain series that's currently running at the moment?
Yeah.
So rather than trying to justify that in terms of the voice that this gives to subaltern community, something that I think you and I would see as being unambiguously of positive value, AHRC has pointed in the past to things like the number of viewer hours that particular programs attract. You can see they have, you know, a million people watches them for an hour, and you can attract that has a value, leisure time has a value of £6. So you attract a kind of putative price to it. And when you start to do that, you start to see that even taking it's slightly problematic, but even doing that, the kinds of benefits that relatively small arts and humanities research projects can be huge. And they might, if you get literally a million people watching a TV program, that's far more effective. That has a much bigger economic effect than a single spin-off company can potentially have. But that's kind of quite a leap of faith, because a spin-off company, your politicians can go, they can cut a ribbon, they can open a science park, but it's much harder for them to take the credit for the investment that leads to a researcher doing a piece of research that eventually gets taken up into TV programs. So obviously things like the Radio 3 New Generation Thinkers that make that link much closer, those kinds of schemes are very positive in trying to make these fairly indirect benefits look much more like direct benefits.
But it's also something that the book, I think, identifies quite well, that many arts and humanities practitioners and discourses are quite uncomfortable with as the way they tell their story and the way they narrate their public value through this kind of set of kind of economic proxies. And I wonder, as a way of kind of getting into some of the nuances and maybe, you know, differences amongst the arts and humanities communities that the book studies, whether you could talk me through some brief examples from the three case study sites of Norway, Ireland, and the Netherlands.
Yeah, I mean, the issue is that the impacts can take place on different scales. So in all three countries, we were able to identify examples of researchers who had profound intellectual influences on their national political communities. And in the case of Norway, on the international political community, always as a kind of second or third order influence. So in Norway, for example, there was in the 1970s, there was a philosopher, Arne Naas, who developed what we now think of as deep green philosophy. That is to say, thinking about the world, it's the Gaia model as an integrated holistic ecosystem in which humanity should, in order to understand the welfare of the ecosystem, you need not to privilege humanity's position within that. Now that was developed as a very what you'd say academic, philosophical position, very abstract, but through the work of the Limits to Growth and contacts via the Club of Rome, it suddenly became a way of articulating a political philosophy that increasing numbers of people were willing to embrace. So you saw in Germany in the 1980s, when you were getting acid rain and the deaths of rivers and the deaths of lakes, people were desperately searching for an explanation that didn't simply say we should put more filters on the end of factory chimneys. And through the work of the Brundtland Report, you see that the ideas from Arne Naas were taken up and became integrated into a political movement. Although I said he was abstract, he was himself relatively politically active in Norway. But these ideas become taken up in national political communities, international political communities, and form the basis of what we now think of as green politics, something that's now seen as being in the mainstream in many countries. So I think it's about 10 million people at the last Europarliamentarian elections voted for parties that have political philosophies that derive from the work of this very abstract Norwegian thinker in the 1970s. And that reflects the peculiarities of the Norwegian system that's enabled someone to devote a huge amount of time thinking about a topic and without really being pressured into delivering it. But it at the same time shows that even where we think that humanities professors are living in ivory towers, what determines the usefulness of that research for society is whether or not it is taken up. And the problematic you alluded to, the resistance that emerges from humanities scholars, is where they feel that they are being forced to take their research and sell it before it's ready. And some of the stories that we gathered were able to show that sometimes it's precisely the time that it takes to ripen the understandings are precisely what's necessary to deliver that usefulness. So again, there's a similar kind of story emerges in Ireland, where Philip Pettit, who was a scholar of republicanism, was invited by Prime Minister Zapatero in Spain to try and produce effectively a second democratic revolution, a sort of new republicanism. So the Spanish democracy had been cobbled together very quickly in the 1970s, effectively more concerned with preventing a resurgence of Francoism than producing a coherent state, a coherent functioning constitutional democracy with equal rights. And so Zapatero was very keen to ensure that groups that he felt were falling through the net, in a constitution that was still very strongly influenced by the Catholic roots of the country, he wanted to create a political program in which produced a new constitutional settlement reflecting more pure republican values. And so Philip Pettit came, he'd made contact with Zapatero in opposition, he was invited in to give advice, he was part of a commission that monitored the Zapatero reforms, and gave feedback at the end. And so you could see that his very abstract work producing the encyclopedia of philosophy definition of republicanism, you saw this very abstract understanding being implemented in a particular constitutional setting very, very successfully in particular areas, particularly around rights for unmarried women. In the case of the Netherlands, there's a much more interesting, a kind of a different example when the Dutch Institute for War Documentation was brought in to study the catastrophe around Srebrenica, where Dutch soldiers were supposed to protect Bosnian Serbs in an enclave, and the enclave was captured by Serb nationalists, leading to a massacre. And this was a profound psychic trauma for the Netherlands. There's still on the day of remembrance for the massacre, it's still a big national event, a huge amount of guilt. And so the Prime Minister, Wim Kok at the time, asked the Institute to undertake a study to try and work out what had gone wrong. The Institute had come out of another attempt to work a significant psychological trauma, that of collaboration with the Nazi regime during the occupation and the implementation of the Holocaust in the Netherlands. And that at the NIOT, the name of the institute, had built a reputation as a dispassionate documenter, as a basis for understanding and coming to terms with an extremely traumatic past. And so they were invited to bring those skills of dispassionate documentation to understanding the massacre that took place. And they came with a very damning report that said the problem came from the top, a lack of clarity from the mandate that the government had given the Dutch soldiers. And the government drew their conclusions and resigned. And that was about the time of the murder of Pim Fortuyn that led to a kind of hysteria around the leftism out of control. And in the election that followed, it led to a fundamental shift in the nature of Dutch politics, a kind of making populism possible. And that's something that that's why I dwelt on earlier the problems that emerge in arts and humanities research, because it can sometimes have effects that are seen as undesirable by particular groups because of the way that their value is politically constructed. But still, it's, you know, the fact that the reports, this piece of research, changed the course of the Netherlands. I mean, it also formed the basis for the really coming to terms with and owning up to and the acceptance that the massacre, it was the fault of the Dutch government, and the moral reparations that then had to be made because of the debt that was then owed to the Bosnian Serbs. And so there's a very strong positive claim to be made. But we were worried in the book that what we ended up was producing a story is that the way that you create research impact is to know a prime minister or be invited by a prime minister to do a piece of consultancy. And at the same time, we were able to point to a huge number of initiatives where interesting things were taking place and quite often where you'd not expect it. So I think it was Charles Clarke in the UK in 2002. He evoked this idea of a kind of medieval scholar who was looking at things that was only of interest to himself and two or three other colleagues, and they're publishing articles that one or two other people would read. And we really had a hard look to find those kinds of people, and we literally couldn't find it. So almost everyone within two or three degrees of separation, there was some kind of substantive impact taking place. So the way that abstract philosophers were working with applied philosophers who were working with the decisions that were taking around the funding of a nanotechnology program in the Netherlands, for example, or people who were doing very abstract, this was in the UK, people doing very abstract linguistics who were approached by a UK intelligence, a US intelligence agency to understand if they could produce an analysis of material that was coming out of the Middle East. And these signals, society was continually giving signals that humanities research had a role to play. The society didn't always know until it gave those signals that humanities research could help. But our research project was, for example, running when there was the massacre in Norway in Utøya, when Breivik, the gunman, went berserk and killed, I think it was 80 innocent young political activists. And the politics sort of threw up their hands in their era and said, well, how can we explain this? And a whole set of humanities scholars sort of mobilized a kind of an impromptu public sphere debate about that. And then at some point, the research council was saying, we want to allocate funding to researchers on the basis of the social value that they create. And there was in the newspaper, a professor wrote an article that said, this is completely alien to us. This is not what we're here for. And what was interesting was it sparked a response or a series of responses from professors who'd been involved in, amongst others, the response to Utøya. And they came out and said, well, hang on, you say this, but this is not a fair representation of what we are. And the interesting thing in Norway was that we found that there was two types of professors who had very stable identities about their researchers, and they were very comfortable with the idea of impact, and there were those who saw their role as to do the expert research and to then present it in a way that someone else could take forward, and then there were others that were constructing it together with partners in a kind of co-creation, that was also a very stable, they saw themselves as being blue sky, pure researchers who worked very closely with societal partners. And creating impact happened, and it was related to what they did, but they didn't feel that there's a constraint on them. And that it was we found that in articulated in very different vocabularies in the different countries that we studied. And that was for us very pleasing. And it echoed, for example, what Mike Kitson found in the UK with his his survey of all academics. To what extent do they have an academic identity as pure researcher, and how far do they work with social partners? And although arts and humanities researchers had often the identity of very pure researchers, they were also amongst the group that worked the most with societal partners. And societal partners, working with them, is a sign that someone is interested in your research, is going to use it. It's the kind of the first step on the journey to creating the societal capacity. And so I think as well as this story about the massive impacts that it can have, we were also found corroboration across a number of European settings that arts and humanities research was actively creating value for a huge range of communities through a wide variety of outlets, signaled in a variety of different kinds of ways. And the idea of the Ivory Tower Academic was the exception, if not the norm. And even if you had a few academics in ivory towers, their work was forming the basis for others who were intimately involved in working closely with social partners to do things that were interesting and of value to those partners.
And this, of course, is precisely the new definition of the public value of the arts and humanities that the conclusion to the book grapples with. Yeah. You know, this sort of empirically reframed vision of what an academic researcher is and what they do, but also gesturing towards a reframed, you know, public understanding of their practices.
Yeah, I mean, that's our definition of public value is that it gives society capacities to do things that are valued by people, and the academic researcher creates something that is then taken up by a user, and the user then has influence in a broader network, and sometimes it can ripple out to the scale of a society. And so there is a sense that there's a generational shift is taking place, that you are now starting to see a lot of academics moving into senior positions for whom that kind of way of working is not controversial. Perhaps in the 1960s there was a more Mertonian view of academic excellence in the humanities that emerged out of the struggles that humanities faced then to say that they were rigorous and excellent. And so this kind of ivory tower mentality, or an ivory tower retrospective justification of what you did, was seen as being a way of demonstrating excellence. And I think what you see is that there is a growing awareness amongst academics that academic excellence is not incommensurate with the creation of public value. And of course, the value that the public then brings into it in different kinds of ways, by making resources available in various different ways, that can also influence, enrich, benefit the research. And that can be explicitly through the use of co-creation processes, working with specific community engagement. But it can also be the kind of the informal dialogue that takes place, or the way that social dialogues can influence the academic discourse. And obviously in literary criticism in the UK, a lot of the influential discussions that take place, you would say, are formally outside the realm of academia, but they are still influential for the way that literary criticism research takes place and is also taught. So I think people are starting to realize that engaging with society and having these societal dialogues can have an enriching effect, as long as the academy retains its capacity and sense of self-worth and what it means to be a good researcher, so that creating impact comes out of doing good research rather than being an end in itself.
That's probably a really good place to conclude the discussion of the book, actually. I mean, we've only really scratched the surface of what's in the text. I mean, there's a long engagement with the concept of innovation. There's a lot of discussion about impact assessments. You know, it's a really rich, really fascinating text that I think speaks to a whole range of different audiences, both in terms of kind of stakeholders, but also cross-nationally. And, you know, I think it's an important book for almost kind of everybody to read. But I think as we draw to a close, it might be interesting to hear what you're working on now in terms of you know, you carrying on this interest in universities, in public value, in knowledge production, or are you going in a sort of a totally different direction?
Well, I think what I was taken by at the end of the project was just this issue of the engagement with publics and the degree to which publics, different kinds of publics, public experts, were starting to take, were making these material contributions to the research activity. So you could be doing a science cafe around linguistics, and someone says something to you that sparks you to take the next step in your scientific career. And it becomes clear that the role of publics in scientific production seems to be quite interesting. So I've started to move towards looking at citizen knowledge communities and their interaction with academic knowledge communities. So at the moment, I like to look at difficult cases, because I think if you understand the most extreme cases, it gives you models that can, or heuristics that can help you understand the simple ones. So I'm interested in how citizens mobilize to create knowledge about controversial environmental planning questions. So where, for example, public authorities or big companies say, this is safe, and they say, well, and citizens come together to mobilize to try and create an argument that to mobilize their own knowledges in order to contest in the sphere of expertise. So how can citizens become experts? And that, we're very grateful to the Economic and Social Research Council and the Dutch Scientific Organization for funding that. And that's kind of I've been lucky to get some money that takes me in that direction, because I think that citizen knowledge is trying to understand how we as academics interact with society, and also the relationships that we have. And studying citizen knowledge helps us get beyond the kind of a transmission model, the sort of the pipeline that we create wisdom that is then taken up. And we can think more about the ways in which we have interdependencies with other academics, interdependencies with public intellectuals, interdependencies with citizens as part of this increasingly knowledge-based society.
Thanks for listening to New Books in Critical Theory. On this episode, I was talking to Paul Bennyworth, one of the authors of The Impact and Future of Arts and Humanities Research, which was published by Palgrave in 2016.